Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, we'll have details of the new master plan for Jefferson Memorial Forest. First, a burgeoning prison population and the human and financial costs associated with it has Kentucky lawmakers considering a major overhaul of the state's penal code. Kentucky Public Radio's Tony McVeigh has the story.
In the last few decades, Kentucky's prison population has exploded from around 3,000 inmates in the mid-1970s to almost 22,000 now. The situation is becoming untenable, and lawmakers are anxious to find answers. Louisville Senator Gerald Neal says that's why they're considering wholesale changes to the state's penal code.
I think the public has to be brought into the process, and there has to be an educational process on both sides, on the leadership side and the public side. And we have to come to some understanding of, you know, where are we in the matrix of things? What works and what doesn't work?
A subcommittee co-chaired by Senator Neal hopes to have some recommendations ready by December for action in the 2009 General Assembly, but he says the problem is so complex, an extension will likely be necessary. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Tony McVeigh in Frankfort.
Jefferson Memorial Forest in southwestern Louisville attracts more than 150,000 visitors a year, and forest officials say they hope recommended changes for the future will draw even more. They've unveiled a new master plan for the woodland. Kristen Espelon spoke with parks planner Lisa Height, who says visitors could soon enjoy a whole range of new activities and trails.
In terms of the overall plan, step me through some of the highlights.
Okay. We have a steering committee that's kind of worked with us. They've had three meetings. We've had a couple of public meetings. We have a number of focus groups with the trail users, with volunteer groups, with natural resource professionals, with environmental education folks. And we did a survey. Horizon did an internet survey to help us get a feel for who does use the forest and how many people use it and under what circumstances and where do they come from. We rolled all that into a plan that recommends looking at the significant natural resources, which tend to be in the central area of the forest, the more interior areas where there are higher quality woodlands, important wildlife habitat. At the eastern and western ends of the forest, those are the heavier use areas, and they're recommended to continue with heavier use and even add some uses. On the eastern end of the forest, where there currently is the Welcome Center and the Tom Wallace Lake and the Horine Manor House and Corporate Retreat Area, those are recommended. We're recommending a potentially new location for the Welcome Center that would be allow more activities to happen there, more volunteers, more guests, more interpretive activities on a new property that would be sort of a gateway to the forest. We're looking at expanding the camping in that eastern end of the forest and expanding, relocating the Nature Center, which is now up in Horine in a very small, modest building, kind of hard to get to. We would bring the Environmental Learning Center down closer to the Welcome Center and expand that. We hope to include some overnight lodges or open-night facilities for groups that are coming out and want to really get into some more in-depth understanding about the natural resources at the forest. On the western end, we're looking at a potential equestrian center. We've been hearing for years from folks in the equestrian community that they need a place, particularly the 4-H groups in Jefferson County, don't have a place to have their shows and clinics. And we're also looking at a resource management center on the west end of the park that would be a place for research to happen. We would hope to, University of Louisville does some research. The biology department works, has some plots and does some research in the forest. And this would be a place for those folks to have a little headquarters and to work with our own natural areas management staff to have plots of different kinds, to have some tree nurseries, to native plant nurseries, and to experiment with different kinds of natural areas management in that area. So that's, and also some expanded camping and some additional trail use in both of those areas.
It sounds like an overall, it's a plan to attract many more users to
the
forest. We sure
do. We really want to connect the community better with the forest. Our Our internet survey found that we have about 150,000 people a year that come to the forest, which we are pleased about that. That was a good amount. We have plenty of opportunities to increase that number, and we'd really like to, we're working on trail connections from some of the neighborhoods around the forest to help people come by foot and by bicycle and even by horseback into the areas that will be designated for those uses.
I wanted to ask a little bit about invasives. How much of a threat are they, and what are some of the major invasives you're tackling?
Boy, throughout the whole park system, and this is across the country as well, this is a huge threat to the environmental integrity of our park systems. We at the forest, probably bush honeysuckle and tree of heaven, English ivy. There are a lot of plants that people, burning bush, a lot of plants that people have planted in their yards over the years. Some of them are quite lovely and look nice in a yard, but happen to spread really quickly and sort of take over the understory for the native plants. And they really outcompete the native wildflowers and understory plants. We have several volunteer groups throughout the park system and particularly at the forest who are working on that, who come out and work on weekends and pull weeds and work with our park staff. It's a monumental task. It's everywhere. And the more interior parts of the forest are less impacted, so that's another reason that we're particularly wanting to protect those interior areas, have hiking trails probably only in the interior and not open it up, because it is the opening up edges at the edges of the forest or for other activities that we've noticed that that's how the invasives get in there.
Are there any other threats to the forest that you are managing for?
Well, you know, part of the challenge is that it is a huge forest. We have many neighbors. Many folks most of our neighbors are really good stewards of their land and keep an eye out on the forest as well and alert us of problems that they may see in the neighborhood. We do occasionally find people who are logging in the area who encroach on the forest. And so we have to be very
not logging vigilant. In the forest, but
well, it has happened. And we've stayed on top of it. We've caught it. You know, we're really vigilant about that. And, you know, we're asking people to be aware of those issues and to work with the State Forestry Division to ensure that that doesn't happen. And, you know, this is a time where people are, economic times are difficult and challenging, so people are looking to their resources on their land. And you know, if they do it responsibly, you know, that's one thing. Sometimes it's not done responsibly, and that can certainly impact adjacent land areas around the forest, and it can impact the forest, and impacts wildlife habitat. We'll see wildlife move into the forest in greater numbers, you know, when neighbors have logged their land, and we will see invasive plants move into the forest when that happens.
I've been speaking with Lisa Height with Louisville Metro Parks. Thanks very much, Lisa.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll get details on the fall meet at Churchill Downs. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Elizabeth Kramer talks to the new artist in residence at the Muhammad Ali Center. First, live racing gets underway today at Churchill Downs in a 26-day fall meet. Stephanie Sanders spoke with Darren Rogers at Churchill to talk about what's new this meet.
Well, the most noticeable change for the 2008 fall meet is going to be the sounds emanating from the speaker system here at Churchill Downs. In July, at the conclusion of our spring meet, our track announcer, Luke Kreitboss, had an untimely death. He died of an apparent heart attack in the middle of July while calling the races, a day after calling the races at Ellis Park in Henderson, Kentucky. And Luke, of course, had been a popular voice here at Churchill Downs since his arrival in 1999. So we're looking really long and hard at who that next voice of the Kentucky Derby and Churchill Downs will be. And there's only been five track announcers in Churchill Downs' 134-year history. It's an amazing short list of people. And in turn, we are going to have five guest announcers this fall at the fall meet over the 5-week stand. It's an esteemed cast of race callers, with each with a distinct different style. And I'm certain one is going to emerge as the next voice of Churchill Downs when we reopen next spring with the Kentucky Derby.
And how did you guys arrive at who those five would be?
Well, we solicited, obviously, applications from some talented race callers across the country, and really it ended up being an international group. We received nearly two dozen applicants, many of which were talented. And we had a selection committee, and still do have a selection committee of about seven. And we sit around in the room, dissect the audition tapes. We also monitor these gentlemen on their race calls at their racetracks on simulcast signals on a daily basis, and many of which were familiar with their work. And this is a good problem to have. We have a talented group of five that are going to be calling here this fall, and some are some really strong candidates. And I think this is going to give us an opportunity to see us work with them over a week's time, and get some feedback from the customers. Ultimately, this is what we're doing this for: who the customers are going to appreciate, who they're going to enjoy listening to, and I think we're going to look forward to getting some of that feedback.
How are you going to get that feedback?
We can get that feedback by soliciting some of our players around the track during the day. Believe me, they let us know with comment cards and calls to the racetrack and via feedback on ChurchillDowns.com. I mean, we get a number of ways, and it's going to kickstart on the opening week, by the way, with Bobby Newman, who currently calls races at our sister racetrack in South Florida, Calder Racecourse, and then. The second week is an interesting candidate, Travis Stone. He's 24 years old. He's only been calling races professionally for about 3 years, but his talent outshines his what I would call lack of experience. This is a star in the making, Travis Stone. Golden Gate's Michael Rona will be in week three. Michael is Australian. There's never been a foreign accent to call at Churchill Downs, and Michael has been in the United States since 1990. He's called at a number of different racetracks, Hollywood Park. In fact, he's called some of the great moments in horse racing history: Cigar, 16-way win streak back in 1996. That 16th race was at Arlington Park. Michael called that event. He also called Lafitte Pinkai and Russell Bays their record-breaking career win totals at Hollywood Park and Golden Gate. So the fourth week is a veteran race caller, Larry Colmus, very popular, based on the East Coast. He's called at Gulfstream Park in the winter, and then Monmouth Park in the summertime. And Larry, for example, is the voice of four of Big Brown's victories this year, believe it or not. He called him a couple of times down in South Florida, and then, of course, twice this summer at Monmouth Park. And then the real wild card of the bunch, I think, is who's going to close on the meet on closing weekend, is Mark Johnson from England. Not too many people are familiar with Mark's work, but Mark is one of the, if not the most respected race caller in all of Europe. And so this is a really interesting, diverse cast, and we're interested to see the feedback from our fans.
And then what do you think the timeline will be once the meet is wrapped up? Is it going to be in a hurry to try to name the next race caller?
Oh, we're not in a hurry. Obviously, we have until you know, next April, for the end of April, for the start of the spring meet. But I would expect the committee to reconvene shortly after the meet, and I think we could have a decision by mid-December, and that announcement would come likely thereafter. So I would expect an announcement before the end of the year.
Okay, and then what other changes are taking place at Churchill Downs this fall meet?
Well, you know what? We're going high def here at Churchill Downs, and that's an interesting new venture where I think you're going to see about more than 100 new high def televisions located throughout the facility. I think about 40 of them are in some of the upscale areas, such as the turf club and the Matt Wynn dining room and some other areas and on the suite levels. But there's a great number of them that are going to be located in the lower clubhouse and on the first floor of the grandstand, so all patrons can enjoy them. In addition to that, Churchill Downs is going to be distributing its signal in high definition. So if there are off-track betting parlors or other racetracks across the country that do have high-definition television, they'll be able to take Churchill Downs signal. And that's actually, you know, Keeneland Racecourse was this fall has unveiled their high-definition television. It's available only on track. We're making it on track and both off-track availability. And the crispness of those horses competing, you know, it's a sport filled with such beauty and pageantry. Watching a horse race in high definition is something else. And I think our signal is really going to stand out at those places. And we're curious to see if that helps move the needle a little bit from a wagering standpoint. That's something that we're really excited about as well.
Sure. And you guys are the first U.S. racetrack to offer your simulcasting in high def.
Yep.
I guess... Is that primarily what was moving it? Is that you're hoping to, I guess, maybe attract new people to racing or get that needle moving a little bit,
absolutely.
As you said?
Absolutely. That's part of it. And let's face it, it's technology. I mean, we're a progressive company that likes to move with the times, especially on technological advances. I mean, I think it's not too I can envision a great number of racetracks eventually in the next 5 to 10 years being nothing but high definition. So we want to move with those times, and we're trying to stay ahead of the curve, which I think we are. You know, another interesting thing at the fall meet is a new wager called the Z5. In the springtime, we offered a wager called the Super High Five, and what that did was it was an attempt to create more jackpots, big payoffs. The customers like to chase those big, hefty paydays, several thousand-dollar payoffs. And the Super High Five was offered on our last race of the day. It involved correctly picking the top five finishers in order. It was a $1 minimum wager, and it was very popular and well received. In fact, we had more than 100 payoffs of more than $10,000, including one lucky winner in sometime in June that brought home more than $107,000 for being able to do that. So we're looking to take it a step further, and this new wager is essentially the same wager, except it's called the Z5 in honor of a zigzag. The wager is going to take place every day at Churchill Downs in our third race, and if no one correctly selects all five, there's a carryover. So let's just say the carryover could be somewhere around $30,000. That carryover will then shift over, zigzag down to our sister racetrack, Calder Racecourse, for race 6, and people in that race will then attempt to select the top 5 horses in order. If nobody does it then, the jackpot carries back to Churchill Downs for our 9th and final race, or 10th, I'm sorry, for the last race of the day, which is typically race 10. So what we're doing here is usually you have these daily jackpots. Well, now we're creating jackpots within the day, and we're going to see if it's something that's popular. We've introduced a number of new kind of wagering innovative ideas to potentially attract more interest from our core customers and interest from newcomers. An example of that was the Matrix, where you're able to get 15 different combinations of bets, a lot of action, for a discounted price of $9. It's a combination of win, exactas, and trifectas. And those are for those people that don't really know what they're doing when they come out here. They're kind of first-timers, but you name three horses, and they've got any combination of those horses running in the top three, they're going to get back X number of dollars. And so those type of wagers you're going to see continuing to be unveiled at Churchill Downs, I think, over the years. We're trying to move the needle.
And then tell me a little bit about special offerings you guys are having on opening day.
Yeah, we've got a really great promotional lineup for the fall meet with some giveaways and some other entertainment around the racetrack. The giveaways on opening day, in fact, I'm looking at a calendar now, and it's beautiful. It's a 2009 wall calendar sponsored by Humana, and the first 5,000 people in attendance on Sunday, October 26th, are going to receive this beautiful calendar. It's got images of beautiful images of horses and fields here at the racetrack, Kentucky Derby Day, etc. And it's one of the best ones I've seen Churchill Downs do. On October 31st, Halloween, the Friday afternoon, in association with the Kentucky Thoroughbred Association, we're going to offer free general admission to the first, or actually not the first, to all full-time college students with a proof of ID, and we're going to have 10 drawings that day, one after each race, and each drawing will be for a $1,000 scholarship. They're also going to have some other giveaways from AT&T, and I think the first 500 college students in attendance that day are going to get a free T-shirt. It's a way to get some of the college kids involved and for us to be able to give back to them as well. And then I think the most popular and some of the real highlights of the fall promotional items are going to be a series of three glassware giveaways with drawings by the Daily Racing Form's renowned artist Teb of three Cajun jockeys. On November the 8th, that's a Saturday, the first 5,000 fans are going to get a Calvin Burrell glass. Robbie Alvarado, a glass of depicting his image, is going to be given away on Saturday, November the 15th. And then on Saturday, November the 22nd, Kent DeSormo, who, of course, won this year's Kentucky Derby on Big Brown, there will be a glass giving away to the first 5,000 fans depicting him. And those jockeys are going to be available to sign autographs the following day of those glasses. So it's going to be something, I think, a collector's item that people are really going to enjoy for the fall.
You can learn more about Churchill Downs and the fall meet at our website, WFPL.org. This month, the Muhammad Ali Center brought on Patrick Gallagher to be its first artist-in-residence. Throughout the year, Gallagher will create paintings depicting the 10 most inspirational women in Louisville. Elizabeth Kramer spoke with Gallagher about how he discovered that he was an artist and his plans for this new project.
How did you learn you would be a resident artist at the Muhammad Ali Center?
Well, it's actually a pretty neat story. I was at a bar here in Louisville one evening, and a gentleman walked up to me. He looked homeless, actually, and he said, are you an artist? I was drawing. I said, well, some people think so. He goes, you need to go to the Ali Center tomorrow morning, 10:30. I said, really? He said, yeah, there's an artist named Simon Bull. He's opening a show. The champ's going to be there, and he's getting older, and you need to meet him. I was like, yeah, all right, buddy, thanks. And he goes, no, I'm serious. And I turned around, and I said, thanks, I'll think about it. And he's like, go. Next morning, I was at the gym, and I looked at the clock at 9:45, and I swear his eyes popped into the middle of my head, his drunk red eyes. And I was like, I better go to the Ali Center. And I went down, and I just sat there, and I just started doodling. And 20 minutes later, Lonnie Ali walked right up to me. And we started talking, and I told her how 3 years ago I was found out I was an artist, all this stuff. And she said, take Mr. Gallagher up to meet Muhammad immediately. And they whisked me past like 60 people. And I met Muhammad. People started snapping photos. I told him my story. And Simon Bull, who's a phenomenal artist, came up to me and he's like, your work's great. And he goes, your story's unbelievable. And I go downstairs and next thing you know, my name's being screamed out in the Ali Center. Some film crew wants to film me. And I go upstairs and I said, Simon, you all right with this? I said, this is your show opening. I feel like I'm stealing your thunder. He said, Pat, this is your shot right now. I said, are you really? Are you okay? He goes, Pat, this is your shot. I was like, really? Is there anything in my teeth? And I said, let's roll. And came down from that, and Anthony Henderson said, you know, we've been looking for a resident artist.
Well, what was the path that led you to be a resident artist, and what kind of art, if you could describe what you do?
When I found out I was an artist, it was February 2006. I had no idea. I've never had an art class. I was a doodler. And I was miserable. I really was. I was 240 pounds. I was on Prozac. I was on blood pressure medication. And found out I was an artist. A local woman named Sandy Barber said, let's do a show and try to use pastels instead of just Sharpie markers, which is what I use. And I said, what are pastels? And she told me, my children taught me how to paint with pastels. And from the first picture, I turned to my wife, I was like, I'm on to something. Next thing you know, I started losing weight, got off Prozac, got off blood pressure medication. I've never been happier. My entire perspective of the world's changed. And I know who I am now.
And what's the perspective of your art and the subject matter?
Women are the main subject matter. I've come to the realization that women tend to inspire pretty much everything here. You know, if it wasn't for my wife, I would be sitting in a cave somewhere. And I find in looking around, you know, I'm the kind of guy that I now pay attention to details with women, how they inspire those around them. And 99.9% of the time, they don't get the credit for it. I know that it's two reasons why I've had success in the art world. It's because of the women around me and because I'm here in Louisville, Kentucky. And the support that I've had has been tremendous. And so I pay attention to the details. It could be somebody, a woman who goes into a local Starbucks every day and gets a cup of coffee. And what she does to the guy in line saying, oh, that's a nice tie. And all of a sudden you see the gentleman's shoulders go back. It's simple little things that most women don't get credit. And the idea behind my art is I try to capture that beauty because it's beautiful. You know, my wife says, I've never met a woman I haven't found beautiful. And it's something where I try to capture that.
And how does your work intersect with the values of Muhammad Ali and the mission of the Ali Center?
Well, it's something where everybody has greatness within themselves. And I'm a living, breathing example of that. I was waiting to die kind of thing. I was miserable. And when I found this, and I found that this was my calling and my passion, I went for it. And I made it, and I'm trying to make it happen kind of thing. And some people say I've made it happen. And that conviction and that passion ties right into the Ali Center, into their six principles of really standing up and saying, this is me, and being proud of who you are. First woman to ever critique my work. She's got 3 art history degrees. She said, Pat, I'm amazed at your audacity to even hang your work in public.
Why is that?
She was jealous. She came back about a month later and she said, I really sincerely apologize. I was jealous. I've been doing it for 20 years and I've sold 5 paintings. You were doing it at the time. I was doing it 6 months and I'd sold 30.
And was there something audacious about your paintings?
Well, it's one of the things that I tell people, it's not that I'm that good, but I connect. I connect to people. If I was to paint you, I don't put a face on it, but I tend to capture your essence. That's what people tell me. And so if your friends walked in to your house or somewhere and they would look at it not knowing that it was you and say, Elizabeth, that really reminds me of you. And that's what I do.
What will you be doing during your residency and how long is it at the Ali Center?
It's part of a new program that essentially we like to say we're building the plane as we're flying it. But what I'm doing right now over the next 6 months, 5-6 months, I'm painting the 10 most inspirational women of Louisville. And I'm out 2-3 nights a week. I go out after my wife and kids go to bed because I hate missing time with them. And I'll sit in a bar and I'll draw and I'll paint or I'll go to an event. And people stand out. If you watch and you pay attention to people walking around, you'll see inspirational people around you every day. It's just the people are so focused on, this promotion I'm working on or this paper I'm doing or whatever, that they don't pay attention. I pay attention. And so I'm painting the 10 most inspirational women that I see around Louisville over the next 6 months. And the idea is that we're going to unveil them the week of Derby at a huge star-studded party out of the Ali Center.
Do you know any of the women that are going to be in it now?
I do.
Can you reveal them yet?
I've only been in Louisville 6 years, and I understand it's... I'm still making my way in the art world, and so I'm creating a buzz a bit. But some of these women are sung heroes, as I like to say. Some of them are ones that you would know. There's a lot that you won't, and in some ways are the next generation. The woman I'm painting now, this is a woman, everybody she touches does their best. You wouldn't know her name, or maybe you would, but 99% of the people listening wouldn't. But I guarantee you within 10 years, they will.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Absolutely.
Elizabeth Kramer spoke with painter Patrick Gallagher. When we come back, I'll speak with author and historian Annette Gordon-Reed. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, a conversation with Israeli author Edgar Caret. First, in the 1990s, author, historian, and New York Law School professor Annette Gordon-Reed explored the 38-year relationship between Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, his mistress and slave, at the Monticello Plantation in Virginia. Her research resulted in the book Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, An American Controversy. Now, Gordon-Reed is back with The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family, which delves further into the Hemings family tree. I spoke with Gordon-Reed during her recent stop in Louisville. Well, how did you get interested in this, going back in President Jefferson and the Hemings family?
Well, I became interested in Jefferson as a third grader when I read a child's biography of him that talked about, you know, his early life and so forth. And I was very, very interested because here was a person who loved books, who loved to find out about the world. And I thought that that was very much like myself. I love books at that time. You know, you're at that age and you're discovering books as a wonderful tool and as a way of sort of going into different worlds. And so I had that identification with him. I was also interested in the fact that, you know, it mentioned that he'd written the Declaration of Independence and he was a slaveholder as well. And so that was something that piqued my interest. It seemed, you know, how could you have one and the other there together? So he seemed to me to be a fascinating person, even from an early age. I didn't find out about the Hemingses until I was a teenager and read a couple of books, Winthrop Jordan's White Over Black and Fawn Brody's book about Thomas Jefferson that mentioned the family. And so I sort of came to Jefferson first, and then the Hemingses were definitely after that.
How did he and the Hemingses come to meet?
Well, there was a woman named Elizabeth Hemings who was the matriarch of the family, and she was born in 1735, and she was owned by a man named Francis Epps. And his daughter, Martha, married a man named John Wales, who brought Elizabeth to his home called The Forest there in Virginia. John Wales had a daughter, Martha, and that daughter married Thomas Jefferson. So it's how enslaved people go from family to family through inheritance and so forth. And so that's how the family came to Monticello in 1772 when Jefferson married Martha Wales.
Now, were there offspring of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings? They have children?
Oh, yes. They had seven children. Four of them lived to adulthood. That was fairly common in those days for people to lose children, something that seems unfathomable to us now. But even with Jefferson and his wife, they had six children and only two of them lived to adulthood. So there's a mix of happiness, but also sadness as well with the loss of children.
What, if anything, do we learn new about Thomas Jefferson from this book?
Well, you get to see him in a light that you don't typically see him. Most Jefferson biographies are about Jefferson and his political life, and understandably, that's a very, very important part of American history. But you see here Jefferson dealing with enslaved people, his sort of dealings with this particular family that was somewhat different from other slaves down the mountain, but it's a much more personal portrait of him in his sort of day-to-day life in ways that we don't typically see in other Jefferson books. So it's Jefferson the statesman, but it's all Jefferson the person on a day-to-day basis.
You've obviously become very acquainted with Sally Hemings over the
yes,
years.
Yes.
What would you say to her? What would you ask her? What would you talk about if she were here today?
Well, one of the things that I would want to ask her, when Jefferson was minister to France at the end of the 1780s, and James and Sally Hemings were living there with him and his daughters at the Hotel Langeac, at one point she wanted to stay in France because in France, black people, there was no slavery in Paris. And so she and her brother wanted to stay there. And I'd like to ask her, what did she plan to do? You know, I'd like to know what her life was definitely like being a person. If you're in Virginia, you're a slave, and then you go to this place, and not just for a short time, they were there for years. What was it like to live as in a place where people looked at you and didn't see you necessarily as a slave, because most people of color in Paris at that time were free people. So it would have been a completely different sense of herself. And I would like to sort of know what she felt about those years.
And this is quite an exhaustive book in terms of your research. How long did it take you to put this together?
Well, it's something I've been thinking about many years, but working steadily on this book, 7.5 to 8 years.
Wow. Wow. And now you have a legal background, legal mm-hmm. profession. How did this help you in the process?
Well, I think one of the things that legal training does for you, and actually when being a law professor, what we do with our students is to try to question our students about documents, about people's statements and so forth. And there's a degree of, there's a way of analyzing problems that I think law school and certainly being a law professor working with students sort of brings out in you, sort of questioning things in ways, not taking things for granted, and sort of trying to see, get to the heart, get to the issue. We always call this issue spotting. What is the serious point that you want to bring out here? And so I think that that's sort of cut to the chase way of doing things is very, very much part of legal training.
Back to Sally Hemings. What became of her after Jefferson's death?
When Jefferson died in 1826, she and her two youngest sons, two of their children had left Monticello to live as white people and moved up to Washington. But their two sons remaining, they took her and they moved into Charlottesville. She was listed on the 1830 census as a free white person. And then on the 1833 census, they did a special census to go and ask free blacks if they wanted to go back to Africa. And in that, she's described as a free mulatto woman, and she declines to go back to Africa. That's sort of an odd request for somebody who was a quarter black. If she wanted to go, she'd better go back to England, which in Wales, which was her father's heritage, her mother and father's heritage. But she died in 1835, and there are one of the things that I want to do in a next book is to really sort of investigate that time, the 1830s, when she is there with her sons. This book ends pretty much with Jefferson's death, and that's when the family who had been at Monticello for 50 years is dispersed because Jefferson died bankrupt and everything had to be auctioned off. So I'd like to really pick up the last 10 years of her life in the next one and then follow the rest of the family out to through the 19th century.
Now, I'm sure you're acquainted with some of her descendants these days.
Yes. I know a good number of them. They're all over the country, but Madison and Eston Hemings, the two youngest children, moved to Ohio, and Madison Hemings actually stayed there. He had 11 children, and so when you have that many kids, and then they had lots of kids, so there are lots of descendants in the Ohio area, and I actually have met some of them. But strangely enough, this is a part of their family story, but it's not. When I meet them, we talk about the election. We talk about, it seldom ever comes up as a topic.
Were there any big surprises, anything that took your breath that came up during your research for this book?
Well, one of the things that really surprised me was John Wales's background. I mean, he is written of, he's Jefferson's father-in-law, but he isn't written of very, very much. And the story was that he had been trained as a lawyer in England and before he came to America. And I found out that he actually was a servant boy who was brought over from England and given an education here. So that, sort of changes the nature of Jefferson's wife's background. I mean, the difference between being the daughter of a man who was trained as a lawyer, which would point to a middle-class background, and the daughter of a man who'd started life as a servant, it's a pretty big change. And so I actually got a chance to go to England. I went to Lancashire and traced down his family tree and so forth. So that was sort of a surprise, because what you thought you knew something about one person and his life, his beginnings were quite different. It makes him more extraordinary in some ways, because he must have been a very, very talented person to go from that to becoming one of the wealthiest men in Virginia.
You think this book will change the way Americans look at race and racial identity?
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, there's been a sense, one of the things that's I think hope comes through in the book is that this has always been a country of white and black and red. I don't talk as much about Native Americans in here because that's not part of the Hemings family, but the beginnings of America were English people and African people, enslaved Africans, but nevertheless, the culture of these two people melded, even if they didn't mix, you know, all the time physically, but certainly the cultures melded. And America is a black and white country, and it has been from the very, very beginning. And so I'm hoping that will, you could sort of dawn on people, and I don't know what effect it will have, but I think it's something that we do have to keep in mind.
What's the reaction been thus far to your
book? Pretty good. I'm very happy with the reviews, and sales are going nicely, and I'm very happy. It's a long book. They tell me it's readable, but and I know it's sort of a daunting thing, but it has worked out very, very well. I'm very happy with what we've done.
That was Annette Gordon-Reed discussing her new book, The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family. She was in Louisville in conjunction with the Authors at the Library series at the Louisville Free Public Library. Israeli author Edgar Caret has written many best-selling books, including graphic novels and children's books. Their titles include The Nimrod Flip-Out and The Bus Driver Who Wanted to Be God and other stories. His stories have even inspired short films. His work is somewhat akin to the quirky sensibilities of shows like public radio's This American Life and the now-canceled TV sitcom Arrested Development. Caret is in town to kick off Louisville's 2008 Jewish Festival of the Book. Elizabeth Kramer spoke with Caret about his work.
What in your worldview motivates you to write such stories that weave the tragic and the comic?
Well, basically, always when you try to write a story, you try to portray life as you perceive it. And I think that life is both funny and sad at the same time. So I guess it comes out in my stories.
What in your life, growing up in Israel and seeing all that you've seen, contributes to that?
I think that basically there is something in the human condition that it's all about kind of an unanswered yearning, you know, and there is something in this yearning that kind of breaks your heart, but at the same time, it's also optimistic and can be funny. We're failing creatures, you know. None of us wants to die, yet all of us are going to die. We want things to get better, and sometimes they get better and sometimes they get worse, but there is something about our all existence that has some comic qualities to it. I guess when I write a story, I don't want it to be neither funny nor sad. I just want it to be true. And I guess for me, what makes this truth is that mixture.
So which characters and which stories seem to resonate most with readers when you go out and meet your readers and that seem to resonate with you long after you've written them?
I think there is a difference between my readers in Israel and readers in different countries. Sometimes people in different cultures kind of feel more connected to different stories. In Israel, I know many people who connect that to my army stories, because in Israel you have a compulsory army service of 3 years. Overseas, I think that people get closer to, I would say, the more fantastical and fairy tale-like stories.
Which ones do you get the most response about?
In the Nimrod Flip-Out, it was a story called Fatso, about this man who has a girlfriend that turns out at night to be this fat chauvinistic guy who likes to watch sports. You know, this is a story that I know in America, many people liked it. And it was the title story of my first collection in the U.S., The Bus Driver Who Wanted to Be God, about this kind of egomaniac bus driver. And many people that I met here said that they knew him and that he works in Portland or in Arizona or in Denver. You know, they say, oh, I know that guy. The one with the mustache, you know.
How did you come to develop that character and bring him to life? What was it that motivated you to write about him?
Basically, I was going one day down the street and I saw this elderly woman who was trying to get on a bus. And the bus had just stopped in a stoplight. It wasn't a bus stop. And she was banging on the door of the bus, but the driver didn't open the door. And then suddenly she made this kind of gesture that it looked a little bit like praying. And the moment she did that, the gates of the bus opened and she stepped up. And the moment that she did that, I thought about how godlike bus drivers are, you know, just sitting up there, deciding when there is enough space on the bus and when we have to wait for the other bus, and always making us feel guilty when we don't have the exact change, you know. This was just kind of a starting point. But in the end, I really felt, you know, that there was something about this action of somebody refuses to open a door and then suddenly seeing something human in the person on the other side. I guess coming from a region like the one that I'm coming from, where people usually don't see the other and they don't change their mode of thinking, you know, just seeing this guy who refuses to open the doors of the bus one moment and then deciding to do that kind of touched me.
One thing I've noticed about your stories is you also have a lot of different nationalities. It's not always people who live in Israel or the Middle East that are in your stories, but people from all over. And what moves you to write in that kind of international way and pepper your stories with so many different types of people?
Israel is a very multicultural society because it's a country that has a lot of immigrants from each and every country. So basically, I was exposed to many cultures in my childhood. Both my parents are immigrants, you know, they're from Poland. And I spent a lot of time overseas. As a writer, I taught in Berlin. I was a guest professor in Connecticut. I was a member of the International Writers Program in Iowa City. And some of the people that I met overseas influenced my characters. When I wrote this story called More Life, and basically, it was very much influenced by the time I spent in Iowa City.
What do you think from Iowa City? What kind of flavor really infused that story?
There is something that I really like about America compared to Israel. There are things that I dislike too, but what I really like is that there is something that is, I would say, naive in a positive way. This belief, which is almost childlike, you know, this belief that things can get better, this belief people are basically good. Sometimes in Israel, people can get very cynical, and there was something about this yearning and the power of this yearning.
I've noticed that critics and other readers have often mentioned Kafka when they talk about your work. How does that strike you?
I was tremendously influenced by Kafka. I started writing during my compulsory army service in Israel, and basically I started reading Kafka during my basic training, which is just the right time because the situation is completely Kafkaesque around you. And what I really loved about Kafka was his ability to disorient his readers. It just challenges the way that you see life around you, and it makes you feel that you know less than you actually thought you do. It was something that I really wanted to imitate in my writing. Like, I didn't want to imitate Kafka's style, but I wanted to take something from that effect.
Are there any other writers that you grew up reading that have stuck with you, or any that you read today that influence your writing or the ways that you think about writing?
Russian writers like Isaac Babel and Chekhov that influenced me. There are many American writers like Cheever, Bartholomew, and George Saunders, and of course the late Kurt Vonnegut, who was a huge influence on my writing.
Some of your stories have been adapted to short film. How did that come about?
There is something very open about them. You know, they don't have a lot of descriptions, so they leave a lot of room for interpretation. And I think that's what directors and screenplay writers like about them, because basically you can take the same story and make it into a comedy or a thriller, you know, and both those interpretations. Actually, there is a story in my latest collection called Crazy Glue that I saw two adaptations of it. One of it was romantic comedy and the other was a very scary, dark film, you know, and they were both based on the same story. I think it gives the filmmakers a lot of space to operate in.
And what are you thinking about doing next?
There is a project I was involved in. It's a feature film called $9.99, and it premiered in the Toronto Film Festival, and they tried to kind of push it for some sort of a contender for an Oscar nomination for an animation feature film, because it was made by Tatia Rosenthal, a very talented first film director who made a claymation feature film with it, and it features the voice of Jeffrey Rush. It's actually my last project, and now I'm back to writing fiction.
You've also said that you like ambiguity in art. What do you mean by that?
I think we usually try to simplify things to make our life easier. You know, we turn people to good guys and bad guys and rights and wrongs. But there is something many times that it's much more complex than that. And I really think that art makes us deal with the fact that our life experience is more complex than we sometimes want to admit it is.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Kramer talked with author Edgar Caret, who speaks tonight at the Congregation Adeth Jeshurun in Louisville. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at LPM, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.